Oak Room Meetings, Buddhist Summer School, 1973. Sunday, 26th August, 1973.
Let all states of muscular stress strain be released. Especially the neck muscles and the facial muscles. Let that state of ease pervade the mind too. It is when the mind is calm and quiet that one can listen. Hear the words and listen to the meaning. And let this state of ease be with every one of us through the meeting. So today we should consider those words of the Buddha when he said, "All that a teacher can do out of compassion for the bhikkhus, that have I done for you." All that a teacher can do out of compassion. And you will see the deep implication of that, that the teacher met his bhikkhus and the bhikkhus met their teacher in the state of compassion, in the state of that relationship of unity, which allows wisdom to flow out of the teacher freely to the disciples, and the disciples can let that wisdom, both in the letter and the spirit, again to use the words of the Buddha himself, permeate their whole being. See, this way, a remarkable psychological induction takes place. The psyche of the teacher pervades the psyche of the disciple. The two intermingle. One of the deep meanings of the holy feast, the feast of wisdom. It is the union which is utterly free of all grasping, utterly free of possessiveness, and certainly free of any concupiscence. This is the state of chastity. And that is what holds at the psychological level. There is something still deeper. And it goes right into the spiritual depths. And there is a spiritual induction in the true and the great sense of the term. You have heard a good deal about the extraordinary powers that the Holy One wields. This power, to put it simply, is the ability to let transcendent energy, whatever it is, something which cannot be put into the forms of thought and speech, to let transcendent energy flow freely through the Holy One to the disciples. This is the root and origin of the great religious rituals which were practiced. They are considered esoteric, hidden. Naturally so. Who can do this kind of thing? Only the perfected Holy One can do it. But it is in connection with the total nature of human beings that this spiritual induction takes place. Not merely a transference of energy, but an interplay of energy. This is one of the profoundest aspects of communion, the divine communion, so to say, which utterly transforms, transmutes the very being of the person who is capable of participating in this. This is still sometimes practiced. It still happens. Very, very rarely. But all this emerges out of this fundamental precondition, this state, out of compassion. Mahakaruna. And then the Buddha goes on to say, after he has said, whatsoever the teacher out of compassion can do for his disciples, that have I done for you. Meditate, because do not give yourselves cause for remorse afterwards that you missed the opportunity. Here are trees. Here are roots of trees. Meditate. He tells that usually to those who are very close to him. Because like Ananda, for instance, who was his personal disciple, the beloved one, who was his own cousin by birth. He tells that to other bhikkhus also, by and large. Do not give yourselves cause for remorse in the future. Here are trees. Meditate. We in the modern world are circumstantially so hemmed in that it is not possible in all instances to sit at the root of a tree, of a real physical tree in nature, and meditate. But if it were possible to do so, and if one is sensitive enough, you will find it extremely helpful to meditate in nature rather than inside a building. Because consider, nature is composed of living elements, what we commonly use to call through the millennia earth, air, fire, water. There is something alive in them. You have all experienced it. The fire on your hearth, although it is inside a building, there's something living about it. It speaks to you. If you let it, if you are prepared to listen to it and not let your imagination run riot, but just be in communion with it and it will speak to you. Go out into nature and you will find that the air and the sun and the light, you will find that the clouds and the rain and the storm, the lightning and the thunder, they will all speak to you. They will be continually singing a song, the song of your own life, because this very body is made up of just those elements and no other. Fire, air, earth, water, all these things make us up. But we human beings have evolved and grown in such a way that we have lost touch with our family roots. With Mother Earth, with Father Sun. When we go out to seek Father Sun, we do it in order to get tanned. Only rarely does one seek Father Sun in communion. Very rarely. The power and energy, the benediction of the sun is sought for our purposes, to bend that energy to our will to produce our results. And what is the result? To change skin of one color into another color. And then the skin, being just natural good skin, endures that and reverts back to its normal color. It took a non-human, a sprite called Puck, to speak quite correctly about us. Lord, what fools these mortals be. But to be serious, there is this communion with nature which the body needs. The body subsists by virtue of all that we call not one's own body. If that were not there, this would just vanish into nothingness. It would disintegrate immediately. The not-self is indispensable to the self. So, what more sensible as a first step than to be restored to right relationship with Mother Earth and all that the Earth holds for us? Now, you may have noticed that, of course, everyone may not be sensitive in that direction, but if you stand near the trunk of a tree, just stand quietly, what do you feel? Something very curious, isn't it? Kind of a peculiar feeling of being sustained. Sustained unfussily. There's no fuss made about. There's no fuss made about me by the tree when I stand near the tree. It is just there. And it feels as if it just puts out a great arm and enfolds. An invisible protection, so to say, an invisible sustaining. And it is life-giving, and it is quiet. It never accuses me and says, "Oh, you foolish fellow, you did this, that, and the other, and that is why you are in this awful condition needing help." It just sustains. Is this or is this not compassion? The compassion of Mother Earth. The loving care of the true, natural-born mother who just knows what the infant wants. Most animals still have it, that power. The animal mother just knows what the little thing wants. That's one thing. And there's another thing to remember, too. There's an extraordinary parallel in reverse, so to say, between the human being, the human body, and the tree. The roots of a tree are geotropic. They point and grow, and they grow downwards towards the center of the earth. The trunk grows upwards towards the zenith. But that growth soon reaches its limit and it comes to an end. It is a fixed species. It remains fixed like that through the ages. Now you look at ourselves. What is the root of the tree which is each individual man? Man is the upside down tree. The brain is your root. You know how in the Gita, for instance, Sri Krishna tells Arjuna, talks to him about the Ashwatthama tree. with roots upwards and branches spreading downwards. And the leaves are the hymns of the Vedas. With root upwards. And somebody coming in? With roots upwards and branches spreading downwards. Now in our case, the root is not geotropic. Doesn't point to the center of the earth, which is an end point. It's confined to the realm of manifestation. That which comes into being, grows, perhaps comes to fruition, maturing and fruition, and then perishes. Death is the end of that. But this root of the Aswattha tree points upwards to the zenith, which cannot be located in space. It is infinite. It has broken the bounds of all limitation, though existing in limited form. It points that way. It cannot grow up to the zenith, obviously. Just as no tree root grows right to the center of the earth. But what is there in us, then, which makes this root so different from the root of a tree? With our brain is associated mind. Mind which is specific to us as individuals. Not merely a common general thing. If it were, we as a human species would remain restricted, enclosed. We could go just thus far and no further. But this mind of ours, which is completely associated with this body, the body is the focus point of action for this unknown, marvelous energy called mind. This mind, through experiencing limitation imposed by the body, is capable of soaring out of this limitation to the heavens themselves, into the infinite, on its own, in terms of consciousness. You yourself are, in actual fact, though you may not know it, though you may never release it in your lifetime, you are the Lord of the world. As we say in India, Jagannatha. The Lord of the world. But what a lordship. The lordship, to use biblical language for the moment, which was given to man in order that he may have dominion over everything. But we do not understand the real meaning of the word dominion. We think of dominating, which is not the real meaning of having dominion. To have dominion means to be dominus, master of the household, but master not by oppressive might, but through serving as protector. The dominus, the lord, and it applied through the centuries in many civilizations, the lord of the manor, as we would call him, did call him in England, the lord of the manor, was the protector of the manor. You see? So, we are Jagannatha, each one of us, lord of the world, protector of the world. And that protection is effected through service. And if there is to be true service, there can be no domination, because domination has no relationship with compassion or with wisdom. It is of the nature of cruelty, of oppression, of repression. It is of the nature of ill will, of ambition, of hate. What lordship is that? None whatever. But we don't see it. So now, this creature, man, is a parallel to that other kingdom of nature which has produced trees. The roots of the tree downwards, the roots of man upwards. You remember there's a passage, I believe in St. Mark, or wherever it is, that miracle of Jesus when he cures someone of blindness. And in the halfway condition of being cured, he asks him, "What do you see now?" And he said, "I see men walking as trees." Has anybody ever explained that or understood it? Now, you work it out yourself. And when the cure is complete, he sees men walking as men. But you know, it seems to me that the real significance of that is that if one sees, we start as blind children of mortality. When we get partially cured of that mortality, we are at the stage where we recognize our possibilities, begin to see our possibilities. And in the full stage of clear vision, we see the right way in which that possibility can be and should be fulfilled through us exactly as we are. These are the things we don't see and don't understand. So, what extraordinary significance lies in just those few simple words of the Buddha? Here are trees. Sit at the root of the tree and meditate. Now, if you can't go outside and meditate because of climatic and other conditions and so forth, we can sit at the root of this tree, can't we? And you know, just as with a physical tree, the earth is a little bit warmer than it is out in the open, away from the tree itself. It's a little bit more comfortable. There's a comforting warmth just around where the trunk emerges. So too, in the deep states of meditation, as you go deeper and deeper, what happens is that the heat of the body gets increasingly concentrated right up here. Now this, no one need challenge. All the great religious mystics have spoken of it, whoever they were. Buddhists, Hindus have spoken of it. You'll find in St. Teresa, in the interior castle, for instance, mentioning precisely these things. And some of her phrases It comes, I believe, when she talks about the fourth mansion or fifth mansion, or somewhere there it comes. It's just past the middle of the book. You will find her talking just a few sentences, telling you what happens to the body, that it is like a log of wood, and that the heat of the body seems to be all there, and that it feels so light as if you are floating in space. As if. Don't expect to see nice holy ones floating about suddenly, you see. Otherwise they'd never need to charter planes or take tickets to other lands when they go. But you see, the extraordinary significances involved in all that. The deepest significance, one can take that aspect, or one can take so many aspects of meditation and arrive at the same central point. I'll mention the central point. The deepest significance is just this. What is the meaning of meditation? What is the actual fact? What happens when you meditate and when you are really in the state of meditation? The state of meditation is no other than the state of complete and perfect communion. It may start off with a state in which there is a musing. A talking process goes on in the mind. The brain still chatters, but chatters in rather a chastened mood and in pious strain. But whilst that is helpful to most of us, it was to me, all through my young days, certainly. It's a good thing you didn't know me in my pie state. But that soon passes. Soon means it takes some years, but it does. You see? That chatter of the mind gradually disappears. And there is a curious mixture of causes which makes it disappear. A mixture of influences. We all meditate, we all approach meditation in order to get a result. And I spoke enough about this self-oriented approach yesterday afternoon. We all do it in order to gain something. And as long as we are trying to gain something for ourselves, which inevitably is preconceived by us, and by us with minds that are very imperfect, more stupid than sensible, more ignorant than wise, our preconception must of necessity bear the stamp of all our imperfections. So long as we approach it that way, the right thing is never allowed to happen by us ourselves. We defeat ourselves right from the beginning by approaching meditation with a desire to bring about a result. Whatsoever that result may be, insofar as it is formulated by us. This is our problem, this is our difficulty, our obstruction. So, meditate, be in the state of meditation, be in the state of searching reality, don't seek reality or truth positively, decisively. I want the truth, etc. No, be in that open state, and then the state of communion will supervene. However much you or I misbehave, Mother Earth will never throw us out of the earth. She'll sustain us, she'll endure with us, quite silently. And infinitely patiently. Mother Earth produced this. And Mother Earth will take the whole of it back, just like that. Uncomplainingly. So we won't be thrown out at all. Mother Earth gives us everything, whatsoever we do. So too, All Father Mind, to use the great phrase of Hermes Trismegistus, which also Hermes speaks in these terms. Therefore, God, All Father Mind, proceeded to make man in his own image, with whom he fell in love as his only begotten child. And the Trismegistic writings and teaching precede the birth of Christ by several centuries. It's Egyptian Hellenistic in origin. So, All Father Mind will also sustain us and keep us. And if we do not make a noise, that infinite peace and silence of mind, of pure mind, just takes us, what we call our mind, into its own wonderful infinitude. And that is the state of meditation. The state in which these transcendent spiritual energies function freely, unobstructedly, through you, the limited, manifested mortal. Immortality can manifest itself only through you, the mortal. Eternity can manifest itself only through time. This is the marvel of the universe. In the state of deep meditation, we awaken to these realities. I deliberately say realities. They are not the vaporizings of a mind which tries to escape from the hard facts of life. This is what happens to you. And I don't think you'll ever come across a truly holy one who was anything but preeminently sensible and matter of fact in the truly factual sense, and not in the absurd, crazy sense in which we ordinary humans try to be matter of fact. These are realities. This is the liberated state. Liberation, like eternity through time, immortality through mortality, can function only through restriction. If there were no restriction, if there wasn't anything which we, as we ordinarily say, hems us in, the word liberation has no meaning. That which you actually are, and to which there is no opposite, can never be known or sought or released. So you see what meditation implies, the transcendent aspect of it, I say transcendent aspect as if there were a non-transcendent aspect, but it is convenient to talk in these terms. That is the transcendent aspect of it. Rooted in the infinite, the immeasurable, all that is finite and limited can be rightly dealt with. Why do you think one of the world's supreme teachers, Jesus, said, "Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and then all these things will be added unto you"? Not American fashion, mind you. You know, all these things will be added unto you. But all understanding of the multitudinous variety that belongs to the realm of mortality will be open unto you. This is meditation. Don't imagine that we will start here like this, you know, going through our verbal rituals and so forth in our minds. With devotion, yes, I don't for a moment impugn the sincerity of anybody. Of course we are sincere. Of course we are good-hearted. We start with these verbal rituals, working towards a result. And that is the mistake. The result is here infinitely with us all the time. The treasure of heaven is not there. It's not buried in the earth. It is embodied in you yourself. You see, to tread the path, whatever your chosen path be, Theravada, Mahayana, Zen, Christian, Sufi, Hindu, Zarathustrian, Confucian, anything you like, whatever your path may be centered in, start from, be rooted in no path, the transcendent reality. Because then whatever step you take will be inevitably the right one. God is the absolute all, the totality, the infinite reality and truth and beauty and wisdom and everything. And if you start there, and if you are rooted in that, then whatever particularity and limitation you enter into will be divinized by your entering. Perhaps some of you may feel, but you're asking us to start with some sort of blind faith in God. If it is blind faith that rises up in you, then you'll never be able to take even the first step rightly. Real faith springs in us and manifests with the sense of course. It's an of course-ness, that's all. I mean, somehow it just doesn't occur to you to argue about it. It certainly will occur, can occur, and should occur, that you start examining it, and in that process you question and doubt, and all the rest of it. There is a healthy, healing doubt. If I do not have that sort of doubt, I'd just be a little bit silly. That'll be there, yes. But if that sense of course-ness, and it's a calm, balanced sense, is there, then it is real faith. So, Start from there. Then you'll find your meditation is, to use the commoner garden word, fruitful. All the right results will inevitably come. And when they do come, you will discover that it was quite impossible for you, in the most ecstatic flights of your own imagination, ever to visualize these wonderful results. It's quite impossible. Why? Because your mind itself has become so transformed that in that transformed state your vision is the vision of genius and not the vision of the clod. This is how it will happen. Doesn't this make you happy? And if it produces that state of happiness, that calm, that peace, the state of rapture which doesn't make you fall overboard, if it happens that way, it is true happiness. And you know, the Buddha himself says that when the bhikkhu meditates and his mind experiences that peace and that happiness, his whole being, his psychophysical being, becomes impassible and he realizes perfect equanimity. And in that equanimity and ease, the reality of nirvana can manifest freely through him. He doesn't know it consciously. He doesn't want to know it consciously even. But, now I am in nirvana. You know, that's the one extraordinary thing about God as contrasted with the devil. God doesn't know he's God, but the devil jolly well knows he's the devil. Knows he's the devil. So, meditation. Here are trees. Meditate. Now, look at the tree, a tree in nature. The root, it just functions as perfectly as is possible under the circumstances. Depends upon what nutriment the soil gives and what water is there and so on and so on. And everything happens in a harmonious way. What happens with us? We make violent efforts all along the line. We strive hard. This is one of the unfortunate aspects of all the scriptures. They are verbal formulation, I mean. The words are a little bit misleading. In the Buddhist, in the Theravada text, certainly, you find this word striving all the time. Striving, striving, this great effort. But you see, the crown of this effort is supposed to be effortlessness. Now, the effort which restricts the wholeness of our being by trying to make our being be directed towards a limited particular end depletes us of energy. The only effort, if one may use that word effort, which is necessary, is just to be balanced, poised. All manifestation, all structures, all living organisms particularly, manifest the balance of opposing tensions. When that balance is perfect, the creature, the tree, is absolutely perfect and healthy. When that state gives way to imbalance, there is ill health, unhappiness. So you see, our efforts usually tend to produce imbalance. But then you may say, oh yes, but I've got such an excellent teacher, he will put me right. All right, let us grant he will put you right. How many times is he going to repeat that? It is you yourself who have to learn the art of balancing. Mama or Papa picked me up each time I stumbled. But after a time, I walked on my feet. Do I still call upon them to pick me up? It had to come from another world. You walk on your own feet, don't you? Sometimes even under difficult circumstances. That's us too. But we walk on our own feet, you see. Balance. The balance is from within. And if this balance of opposing tensions is at work, the opposing tensions, they are complementary tensions, not antagonistic tensions, then the action is effortless. You look at a supremely accomplished concert pianist playing. You hear wonderful music and you look at his body and his hands and you say to yourself, oh, I could do that with a little practice. Go and do it. And may you have every good fortune. It's like that. The man is a creator. Don't forget that. Creative power lies within us. And creation takes place effortlessly. A meditation has to be effortless. And if that meditation is to be effortless, if it is to be the balance of the forces at play, physical and mental, all of them, and whatever other forces there are, including the transcendental forces I just touched upon right at the beginning, if they are to be like that, then it is something which takes place throughout the day. Make no mistake about it. Meditation is not for 9:30 or 6 o'clock or whatever it is. If you awake to the fact that meditation is a continuous process, a continuous state of being throughout every second of time, then whether from that overriding awareness filling you, you deliberately step into a meditation at 6 o'clock, makes no difference. Then you go through that, but you are centered in this, the totality, the whole, the perfect. Then you make no mistake about it at all. But in order to be able to do that in the right way, there is neither rigidity on the one hand, nor a giving way to the impulse of the moment. Oh, I feel like meditation, like you might feel like having a glass of sherry. Because then your meditation will be, well, not like a glass of sherry, but a bottle of vodka. Not very pleasant.
Leave it alone.
No, just naturally enter into meditation. This is the opportune moment, right? It's quiet, it's beautiful. Everything around me, my whole environment, sort of tells me to meditate. And you enter into the state of meditation easily, effortlessly, and your total environment comes to life through you. You see, we don't know a millionth part of all the wonderful things that happen through each and every one of us living creatures. You may remember I mentioned yesterday, the totality, the infinite, is contained in the minute, the finite, each one of us. And all the time this totality functions through us, we obstruct it. We close the doors. We don't know. Or we make the mistake of saying, oh, so-and-so has said or declared, and of course I trust what he says, you see, that we are made like this. Therefore we make violent splashes trying to be open to all the forces of totality. If all the forces of totality flowed through us, we'd bust. But just be open, resilient, infinitely resilient. And in that infinite resilience, you can never be destroyed. There are some, and this is a very real problem with some people, some of them occasionally come to me and ask me about this. And it's a terrible problem. They say, I feel I'm being destroyed. One young man particularly had an even worse problem, it seems to me. He said, I am spending my whole life destroying myself. What am I to do? See, this sort of thing happens. And it's very, very difficult to tackle. Much of his problem is simply a peculiar imagination coupled with the stress of life in certain directions, frustrations and so forth. Young man, quite young, 23. That's only one instance. These things happen, but they have to be tackled by us individually. And don't tackle it, don't attempt to tackle it from the self point of view. That is the whole point. Just realize that we do not and cannot live unto ourselves. We are part, integral part and parcel of the whole environment. It is not a case of the environment and I, of the not-self and the self. The two are one single unity. Consider, for instance, the manner in which we are self-conscious. I am self-conscious of my... This is number one. You see, very vivid in my consciousness, supremely important. And all the rest is not merely number two or three, but oh, 20 million odd, just insignificant. It's you, it's it, that. Isn't that true? You see how self-centered we are in consciousness. Terribly self-centered. The not-self is such an insignificant thing compared with the self. Look at one of its consequences. Man's tragic madness conquering nature, conquering this, conquering the other, and all the rest of it. What on earth is he conquering? One day, the earth says, right, you are 6 feet for you, available. You see, that's how it is, isn't it? So, the self and the not-self. They are not two separate things. Now, just as I feel that about myself, and actually do function like that in connection with myself, there are 3,500 million other human beings on the globe who are functioning that way. Can we ever have a harmonious human society? Perhaps some of us are engaged in social activities and so on. Well, I am not involved in any, you know, sort of professional social activity. But I look at the situation and say to myself, if I am so unsocial as to be number one and all the rest is just a vague, unimportant something else, a not-self, how on earth can I benefit society if I am so impure, so hateful and hating, separate? The crucifixion as a ransom for the many. Can you and I do that? If we can, it will mean that you and I are in eternal union. The state of compassion, the state of wisdom, of true beauty, when that compassion and wisdom wells forth freely through the individual, then that person sees everything as the beautiful. There is nothing which is ugly, in the ugly sense of that word. Everything is transfigured. Because this is not a mere thought, it is an actual living fact of your own consciousness, your own innermost depth of awareness, that everything is embodied transcendence. Everything is holy. This sort of thing is implied in meditation. When you do meditation by yourself, alone, if it happens to be truly fruitful, when you come out of it, as we say, stay as quiet as possible for as long a time as possible. It's reasonably comparable to the physical process of eating food.